Our subject is Don't Break the Laws of Teaching. Laws are fixed. Teaching has to do with laws that are just as fixed as are the laws of the universe. Teaching is really a process that gets results even as does a process in the physical realm. When we think of laws in the physical realm, we think, for example, of the law of gravity. Or in other realms, we think in terms of the first and second laws of thermodynamics. These are fixed laws. And we again say that teaching is really a process that gets results, and that related to teaching are those laws that are just as fixed as are the laws of the physical realm. Now, physical laws may really be better understood than the laws of the mind, but the laws of learning are just as fixed. To discover and understand the laws of any process really makes it possible to control the process if one can at the same time control the conditions. Any who can master the secrets, for example, of electronics, can devise ways of transmitting messages to Europe. And so it is with teaching. Carrying it over into other areas, there are those laws that obtain in the medical field. Laws that have to do with farming, tilling the soil, planting. Other laws that have to do with construction. Laws that have to do with stress and strain. And then, of course, think of all of the fixed laws that man had to deal with to make outer space exploration a reality. Now, these laws are fixed. Man can depend upon them to act always in the same manner. The laws of teaching are just as fixed. Teaching actually is the communication of experience. And this experience may consist of doctrines or principles or ideas or concepts, or facts, or even ideals. They can be taught by word, whether it be oral or written. They can be taught by signs, by examples, by actions, or by objects. It is the communication of that which is in the mind of another person. It has been said that it is the painting in the mind of another, one's own concepts or ideas. It is the transmission of one's thoughts and understanding to another. A transmission is really more than telling the facts. We are speaking, of course, of that transmission that enables one to reproduce in his own mind that which he has been taught. The one who is taught makes the lesson his own experience. He has learned only when he can utilize the concepts and ideas for his own satisfaction. We repeat, telling is not enough. I think it's been illustrated very beautifully by suggesting that to some people, teaching is simply pouring the contents of a large pitcher in part into a small pitcher. This is not learning. Telling the lesson is just what it is, telling the lesson. It is not by any means to be equated with learning the lesson which has been placed before the students. It is only when the ideas communicated become involved with successful doing that the student has learned. In fact, no real teaching has been done until facts have been translated into action. Now, this simply means that until you as a teacher see your students act upon what you have taught, there has really been no real learning accomplished. You see, the transmission of the facts has to become reality in terms of experience. The facts have to be translated into action. The learner must be able to reproduce the same experience that is set before him by the teacher, so that both the teacher and the learner hold the experience in common. A teacher might communicate the facts and the techniques of playing the violin to a student. He may continue his teaching until both can play the violin. It is at that time that they hold the experience of playing the violin in common. One can teach another how to drive a car, but it's only when one is successful in driving a car that he has really learned to drive. And the teacher and the student thus hold driving a car in common. This would be true of teaching history or theology, or teaching someone how to type or to run a computer. Now, in analyzing the laws of teaching, we note, first of all, that there are two personal factors involved in the learning process. There is a teacher and a learner. It's just as simple as that. There is A and there is B. There is a teacher and there is a learner. In the second place, there are two mental factors. There is a common language or medium of communication. And then there is a lesson or the truth to be communicated. Now, this means that so far as the mental factors are concerned, the teacher and the learner must speak the same language. Not only is this true of the same basic fundamental language in the sense of speaking English or speaking French or Spanish, but it is also true, as we will discover later, that the vocabulary within the circumference of a given language held in common must also be common to both the teacher and the learner. Then, of course, in addition to a common language, a lesson or truth is involved as the second mental factor in the process. Now, there are really three processes involved. There is that of the teacher, and then that of the learner, and then there is a final process used in order to test or fix the results of teaching firmly in the mind of the learner. Now, all seven of these factors are present really in any lesson. and none can be omitted, and no others should be added. In fact, no others really can be added. Every fact of nature is really proof of some law. When it rains, it is proof of a number of laws, all of which are bound up in terms of what we call the hydrologic cycle. Every element of learning has its own law of functions or operations. No one in itself, that is, no particular element in itself, constitutes learning. It takes all seven factors, when put together, to introduce us to the answers to our many questions. And we're thus introduced to teaching and learning as these factors come together, as skillfully operated in the teaching-learning process. All the rules taken together govern successful teaching, therefore. And no teacher needs to fail if he will but make it his business to apply the rules that we're going to discuss with you. The laws really may seem to be very simple, perhaps oversimplified, but their simplicity has been pointed out as being more apparent than real. We can go so far as to say each law varies in its application to the minds of different people, although the law itself remains inviolate. All of which means that people learn basically by the same laws. They may learn at different rates. And this means, of course, that some learning may be more slowly accomplished than in others. In that event, different techniques of learning must be introduced into certain learning situations, as in the case of older citizens. And nevertheless, the laws are very real, and when handled skillfully by the teacher, the satisfaction is achieved by the learner. Each law relates to other laws and facts until it reaches, as it were, the circumference or the limit of the art of teaching. The rules apply to all teachers of all subjects as they are taught to all age groups. There are no exceptions. They are applicable in the kindergarten and in the university. These principles of teaching apply to all teaching, whether it is in secular school or in the Sunday school. And we, of course, are primarily interested at this time in the Sunday school. It should be observed that there may be many successful teachers who have really not heard of the laws as we will present them to you. They seem really to do naturally what needs to be taught to others. Some people play the piano rather beautifully by ear. They seem to do naturally what others do by law. There are some people who speak very intelligibly, but who really do not know all the laws of grammar. Now, a recognition and practice of the laws of teaching need not make for a dull teaching of the individual or dull classes. On the other hand, such recognition can make for greater success in teaching than ever experienced before. Skillful teaching should not be viewed as a hindrance to instruction. Some people are afraid of becoming involved in the various techniques of teaching, in the laws of teaching, in some of the finer points of communicating experience to others. And they have a tendency to view any application of law to teaching as really a hindrance to instruction. The purpose of such teaching is to provide the student with the best learning experience possible. Some teachers are very coldly intellectual, and other teachers are frothy and sentimental. And on the one hand, we have a frigid presentation, and on the other hand, we have a frothy, emotional presentation. Now, there is a happy medium, and we would propose that the practice of the laws of teaching in dependence upon the Holy Spirit will produce profitable and a very satisfying teaching, learning experience. Now, I'm going to present to you, with this introduction, the seven laws of teaching. These laws were formulated by Dr. John Milton Gregory, a great and notable educator of past years. If I recall correctly, Dr. Gregory was associated with the University of Illinois. He came up with the seven laws, and his little book, The Seven Laws of Teaching, will probably continue to be the source material for these laws for many years to come. It would be a very wise thing if every teacher owned this little book, The Seven Laws of Teaching, and here they are. There is what he calls the law of the teacher, and this is very simply put. The law is that the teacher must know that which he would teach. Now, in terms of mathematics, we say that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. That really is to state a fact, and it cannot be controverted. The law of the teacher is that the teacher must know that which he would teach. This is a statement of fact, as well as a statement of principle, and it cannot be controverted. Now, this simply means that what a person does not know, he really cannot teach. The person does not know the Mandarin language, he certainly cannot teach this Chinese dialect. One, in order to teach, must know his lesson. Now, think in terms of the body of material to be taught, that is, the lesson to be taught, or the series of lessons to be taught. A series of lessons to be taught by the Sunday school teacher in a given quarter. Now, if the teacher does not know this material, If he wavers in his knowledge of it, he will be totally unable to teach it. And the result is just as one would expect. The student will not learn the lesson, and he will certainly not be motivated by the words of the teacher. Now, the teacher knows this material by setting himself seriously to the study of it. He will read through the lesson manual. He will take cognizance of the scripture that is being used as the foundation for the lesson. And he will not be content with the comments of the manual, but he will do research himself. He will, of course, pray over the lesson. He will ask God to reveal the truth clearly to him by the Holy Spirit. Then he will go to the commentary, and he will pick the minds of the expositors who have produce the commentary. He will go to the Atlas, to the Bible Dictionary, and he will come up with much material from which he will construct his lesson. Now, as a result of such research, we believe that the teacher will be introduced to the great and salient facts of the lesson. There is every reason to believe that after applying himself in a dedicated fashion to learn the facts and the significance of the facts involved in this lesson, it's reasonable to believe that he will know the lesson and be capable of imparting it to others, so far as the facts are concerned. Now, he might know the lesson very well and fail to really communicate it, and that involves other matters. But so far as this law is concerned, he knows the lesson now that he would teach, because he has explored its truth. The second law is the law of the learner. And Dr. Gregory has put this law before us thus. The learner must attend with interest to the material to be learned. Unless the teacher gains the attention of the class, learning will not be accomplished. We have often said that learning begins with interest, and the teacher must have the attention of the class, otherwise the class will never learn the lesson, and the experience that the teacher desires to communicate will never be identified with his students. Interest, of course, will vary with pupils. Now, whatever interrupts the attention of individuals in the class at the same time interrupts learning. Interruptions are discipline problems, because anything that interrupts the learning process or the regulated training of the students becomes a discipline factor. So whatever interrupts attention in the class really can be said to interrupt learning. The teacher will do well to stimulate interest in every way open to him as the teacher. The interest in a given subject can be intensified by demonstrating the values of the subject at hand to the student. The interest of the student can be captured in many ways. One, of course, by attention-getting illustration or by a life-related experience. The learner must attend with interest. And if the teacher does not capture the interest of the learner, then, of course, the lesson will not be learned in a satisfactory fashion. The third lesson, or the third law, rather, is the law of the language. And that law says that the teacher and the learner must hold the language in common. Now, this would seem to be clear to everyone, I'm sure. It's axiomatic that if two people are to communicate one with the other, the language must be held in common. One cannot communicate to another in Chinese or in Greek if the language in either case is not understood. Now, language is really the vehicle of thought. And the teacher must realize that communication is very definitely a two-way street. In the learning process, we repeat, communication becomes a two-way street. There is, of course, the teaching on the part of the teacher, but then there is the reaction and the interaction on the part of the student or students. The teacher will address the students will address the teacher. Now, to do this, they must hold the language in common. And that simply means that the teacher must understand the language of the pupil, and the pupil must understand the language of the teacher. Now, it's possible for the language of the student and teacher, shall we say, to be English. And yet for the student to fail to understand the thrust of the teacher, because the words used by the teacher or his vocabulary is not the vocabulary of the student. May very well be that words are used in the instruction of the student that should be defined. I really believe that many textbooks take for granted that one knows the subject, this being evidenced by the vocabulary that is used. So many textbooks do not define terms. It would be very helpful if more textbooks were to employ or use a glossary for the aid of the student. And it's a good thing for a teacher to prepare a glossary for a class so that the class will understand the significance of words that are used. Occasionally, there are scientific terms used, or there may be terms used with respect to geography or archaeology or history, or a term might be used in an illustration, these terms being totally misunderstood by the student. In that case, then the teaching learning process is going to be blunted, and it's going to take the edge off of the ability to communicate experience. Words should be defined, explained. I think words should be simplified. Some people have the mistaken idea that they have to be obtuse in their language. They have to be mystical in order to demonstrate a true intellectuality. We must remember that a mark of brilliance is simplicity. And very often words are tossed about by men who in reality do not have much more to offer than a large vocabulary. Words should be illustrated, if necessary. Certainly under all conditions they ought to be clarified, and I might say that on occasion certain words and their meanings ought to be repeated to the students, because with a reasonable repetition, learning can be accomplished. The fourth law is the law of the lesson. The truth to be taught, said Dr. Gregory, must be learned through truth already known. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. Now, all teaching has to begin somewhere. That is, at some point in the subject or the lesson. And it would be necessary to seek out a point of beginning, and that point of beginning has to be a truth that is held in common by the teacher and the learner. In the book of Hebrews, chapter 1 and verse 1, the writer begins with the word God. God who at sundry times and in divers manners. The book is written to Hebrews, and we believe Hebrew Christians. There were many Hebrews, evidently, attending the Christian company who had not as yet made a confession of Jesus of Nazareth as their Messiah, but they were considering Jesus. Now, had the writer to the Hebrews started the epistle with his own name, it might have brought some offense to the Hebrews, because the names of men who once espoused Judaism but then embraced Christianity, that is, they became Hebrews that were converted to Jesus of Nazareth as Messiah, the names of these men were often stumbling blocks to Jews to whom witness for Christ was given. But you see, the writer to the Hebrews began with the word God. The word was held in common by both the Hebrew and the Christian. The Hebrew knew this God by name. He was taught the precepts of this God in the Tanakh, or the Old Testament. So what we're saying is that the student must be taught by means of truth that he already knows. And therefore, the book of Hebrews begins with a statement concerning the God that the Hebrew already embraced as the one true and living God. The teacher proceeds then from that which is known to the unknown. You see, it's axiomatic that all teaching has to advance if it is to be effective teaching. Teaching music has to advance beyond one note, or it certainly has to advance beyond learning the scale in a certain key. All teaching has to advance. That is, if it is to be effective teaching, and if it is to lead the student into new experiences. And knowledge must not be viewed as a collection of unrelated facts. It's the responsibility of the teacher to take one fact and relate it to another, or to link up one truth to another truth. And that which is really known by the student, or shall we say that which is old, must be joined to that which is new, so that when the new and the old are joined, then the new is explained, or perhaps the new is just confirmed. The teacher does well to encourage the student to use what is already known then on his part, and this for the purpose of reaching into the unknown, guided and stimulated or motivated by the teacher. The law of the lesson, then, is that the truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. Now, the fifth law is this. It's the law of the teaching process, and it says, excite and direct the self-activities of the pupil, and as a rule, tell him nothing that he can learn himself. Now, this, of course, may disappoint, maybe even confuse some teachers. Teachers sometimes have the impression that they have to tell the student everything the student must know, and they leave nothing for the student to do by virtue of his own research and the use of his own intelligence. Really, the teacher's task is to direct the activities of the student for the purpose of conserving time and energy. And the teacher cannot and does not learn for the student. The student has to do this on his own. He does this by himself. The student must not then, as we have said before, simply be told the lesson. He must be stimulated to use his own thought processes and to know for himself. You see, the teacher has to excite and direct the self-activity or the thought processes of the student so that the student can know or learn for himself. Comenius, the great teacher, said, in quotes, most teachers sow plants instead of seeds. Instead of proceeding from the simplest principles, they introduce the pupil at once into a chaos of books and miscellaneous studies. And on that Gregory comments, when he says, in quotes, the true teacher stirs the ground and sows the seed. It is the work of the soil through its own forces to develop the growth and to ripen the grain. Now, the law of the learning process is this. The pupil must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be learned. I've said before that teaching is not pouring knowledge or facts from a big picture into a small one, meaning from the teacher to the student. Furthermore, real learning is not memorization, that is, the ability to repeat the precise words or phrases of the teacher. Unfortunately, this may be all that is required by some teachers. Their work is by them considered to be accomplished if their pupils can recite verbatim the words of lesson materials, or to give a memory verse, the one assigned to the lesson. Unfortunately, this is not real learning, and this kind of an operation is far from permanent, and this is matter probably forgotten just as quickly as it was memorized. Now, the teacher has to guide the student into the ability to translate the thought of the lesson into his own words, use his own vocabulary to reproduce the thoughts of the lesson, and to do this without sacrificing the real meaning of the lesson. I think this is an important step, but certainly it is not the real goal of teaching. Urge the student to seek a reason for what he believes to be true. This will make the student to be a discoverer and a pioneer, in a sense, and he will seek to verify his conclusions with certain facts. It's interesting how much truth the student can discover for himself on the way to establishing reason for his conclusion. Now, no lesson is really and fully learned until knowledge is applied to life. Now, this means that truth must result in practical applications to one's life or behavior. What is often idle knowledge, says Gregory, can become practical wisdom. And it's only then that the learning process is completed. In all this, the age of the pupil has to be considered. The mental activity of a small child, for example, is very intimately associated with his senses. His knowledge of the lesson may be very largely limited to what he can see, or that which can be illustrated or demonstrated with the senses. As the pupil develops, he will have a desire to carry out some program, some active program, that can be used in his training. And as he continues to develop, then of course he will more and more become involved in seeking reasons for what is taught. Bear in mind that in each area of human knowledge, there are distinct evidences and applications. And a wise teacher will discover these differences, and he will tailor his methods of study of each for the student. The seventh law is the law of review. That is, the completion and test and confirmation of the work of teaching must be made by review and application. The idea, of course, is to aid the student to attain as complete knowledge as is possible in the light of all the conditions or circumstances, and to confirm that knowledge, thus rendering it ready and useful as related to the needs of everyday living. Review is not mere repetition. Review is rethinking a thought. It involves fresh conceptions and new associations. And as Dr. Gregory points out, it brings an increase of facility and power. This is so important inasmuch as a new lesson does not reveal all of itself at first. We must go back and back to the truth thought, see it all over again, note the context of it, view the truth afresh, because review is imperative to learning. We sincerely trust that you will not break the laws of learning. Thank you very much. And will you turn to the other side?